I have a real treat for us this afternoon. It's a real treat for me because this is the second or third time I'm privileged to do this. And it gets better each time. It gets more interesting each time because you can never step in the water at the same place in the river twice, the same thing. So for that reason, it's good every time. Anybody remember a British singing group? They were kind of a motley crew. They came over here in 1964. They played around Germany a little while, knocked around a bit, and people didn't think they were worth very much and didn't think they were going to make very much of themselves. And somehow the name, the Beatles, stuck in people's minds, and they became something and somebody. We have with us this afternoon one of the two reporters who covered the Beatles on that 1964 tour to America and Canada. The story apparently wasn't worth much to the industry because they only assigned two reporters, one from Liverpool and one from the United States. And the gentleman I'm about to introduce was the United States-based reporter. He'll tell you about himself. He'll tell you a little bit about his background. He'll tell you about his career. He'll tell you about anything he wants to tell you about. And the most interesting part is he's got clips of the Beatles and interviews that he had. And he'll tell you about his time that he spent for those 3 weeks with the Beatles. He'll tell you stories on a very personal level about how Paul McCartney saved his career and several other things. It's a great story, and I'm talking too much, so I'm going to let the rest of the talking go to Art Schreiber from New Mexico. Art, it's all yours.
The long and winding road
from Albuquerque
leads to your door.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Carl, and good afternoon, everybody. And I'm so honored to come back to New York. I love this state, and I love the NFB, as I hope you know. And so thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I do want to remind you that Kevin mentioned this morning about the auction coming up online. Now, I have, as I did the last time we did an online auction, unfortunately, you'll have to pay your way to New Mexico and to Albuquerque, but if you bid on that and win it, you will receive a couple of nights hotel stay in Albuquerque, dinners at two of the finest restaurants in town, and then you'll get to go on to all the museums, ride the tram to the top of the mountain and look out and see the land of enchantment, etc. But you also get to spend time with yours truly, look at my Beatles scrapbook. And the last folks that bid on it, they spent 6 hours with me. So I hope that one of you in this audience bids on that and gets to come to New Mexico and talk about the Beatles. I'm privileged to be able to do this. There are not many people that live long enough to hang around after 50 years and still be able to talk. And so I'm lucky in that respect. Also, Carl mentioned I'm one of two American reporters to travel with the Beatles. The other was Larry Kane, not Larry King now, but Larry Kane. Some of you who might live close enough to Philadelphia to catch KYW's television, Larry was the anchor man for years on KYW television. When I knew him, he was a young reporter from Miami. And he and I were the two Americans who traveled with the Beatles. There were three British reporters. One, by the way, is a good friend of mine, Ivor Davis. He just has written a new book called The Beatles and Me. And Ivor was one of those three British reporters. And then there were two photographers. So we traveled around with the Beatles. I'll tell you, first I want to tell you the answer to the question that I am most often asked about the Beatles. Now, what would you think that is? The question is, well, how did you get on the Beatles tour? That is very easy to answer. I was news director in Cleveland. That's Ohio, folks. And I was just talking to some fans of the Bills. I was statistician for the Cleveland Browns for 6 years for their broadcast in the great Jimmy Brown era when the Browns were pretty good. In fact, I covered the last time they ever were in a championship, and that's the year we're talking about today, 1964. And they won that championship, in 65. And so anyway, I was news director at KYW, which then was in Cleveland. Now it's in Philadelphia. But it was in Cleveland then. And folks, now for you young people, you're going to have to bear with us older folks. I'm the oldest. I thought I was the oldest in the audience until I just met someone who tops me a little bit. But I'm catching up. Anyway, you've got to remember that I'm going to talk to you about time when there were no cell phones. Your story is on what we call the landline. It was attached to the wall with a wire. And so that was the time that we're talking about today. And also, now get this, there was no FM radio. FM had been discovered. And yes, there were stations on the air. And you know what they did? They were so poorly listened to. No one listened to them. So companies just played tapes over and over and over, classical music generally. And one time in Cleveland, we had an FM, and we played those tapes. They got the tape on backwards, and it ran for 2 days. Nobody ever knew it. So AM radio was king. It was it. And companies could only own seven of them at one time, and you could only own one in a market. So, ratings, the fight for ratings was intense. And we at KYW in Cleveland were fighting it out with another company, WHK, which was owned by Metro Media, a big company out of New York. And we fought all the time for the number one rating. And one day I came back from lunch, and I thought I'd stop in the program director's office to shoot the breeze, and I walked in, and all the disc jockeys were sitting around in the same room, and the production manager, the music director, and it was silence, dead silence. I thought someone had passed. And I said, what happened? And a voice said, HK got the Beatles. That meant that WHK had bid and won that bid to bring the Beatles to Cleveland, and they paid $25,000 to bring the Beatles to Cleveland on this first tour of this singing group that really no one knew anything about. Well, they'd seen them on the Ed Sullivan Show a few months before that. And so, I don't know whatever possessed me, folks, but I said, I looked at the program director. I said, why don't you put me on the Beatles tour? He jumped up, ran in the manager's office, and the rest is history. Well, but you haven't heard it all. Whenever we wanted to cover a national story on a Westinghouse station, you had to get permission from the bureau chief in Washington, a job that I would later have, believe it or not. I never thought that I would ever have that job. All I wanted was a correspondence job overseas or a Washington correspondent, and ended up being the bureau chief. But I had been assigned by the bureau chief in Washington to politics, civil rights, and man's space. So I covered the tribal Martin Luther King all through the South. And it was on the Selma to Montgomery March, the Meredith March across Mississippi for voting rights. And I traveled with Jack Kennedy when he was fighting it out with a man by the name of Hubert Humphrey for the nomination of the Democratic Party just to be on the ticket to be president. I traveled with Jack Kennedy before he ever was president. And so I was kind of looked upon as this important guy who covered politics and civil rights and man's space, but certainly not music. And Jim Snyder, when he heard that they wanted to put this guy Schreiber on the Beatles tour, he said, no, hell no. He said, he's got to cover the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. And that's true, I did. I was assigned to cover the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, and it started the same week that the Beatles tour started out on the West Coast. Well, the compromise was that Schreiber would miss the first week of the tour, cover the Democratic Convention, and join the Beatles in New York when they flew from the West to the old Forest Hills Tennis Complex. Now, some of you in here may remember it. That's where all the great tennis tournaments were held in America. And now I understand it's a housing development. But anyway, that's what the compromise was. Now, what is ironic about that, folks, is that the reason I was so, that the bureau chief wanted me covering the Democratic Convention, I had covered so much, many stories on civil rights in the South, and especially Alabama, when Birmingham was burning up, and I'd traveled with Martin Luther King, and I'd gotten to know Bull Connor, who was his the police chief of Birmingham for a long time, and then he became the head of the Highway Patrol under Governor George Wallace. And I knew all those people, and so they wanted me to cover the Democratic delegation to the Democratic Convention. And, of course, that was the Alabama delegation. What's so ironic is here I wanted to really be on the Beatles tour, and you know what? The Alabama delegation walked out of the convention the first night, and I was left not covering very much, and everybody was talking about the Beatles anyway and not the Democratic Convention, and so that's what happened. Now, what I want you first to hear, however, is a wrap-up, as we called it and still do. When I returned from the tour, now I spent 3 weeks with the Beatles. Only the others spent a month. Okay? When I got home, I produced what you're going to hear now called a wrap-up. This gives you an idea of what the entire tour was like, and you will hear in more detail after this. But, Mike, let's hear the wrap-up.
Veterans of show business said they had never seen anything like it, and they admitted they probably never would again. The Beatles tour of the United States is best described as a nearly indescribable, fantastic phenomenon. It was a display of Beatlemania at its very best or worst.
I touched Paul!
I had
touched him. I like that. And he turned around.
Please let me see him, please. Please let me see the Beatles, please.
No, go away. Go away, you made me sick. Go away, you made me sick. We stood out there for 400 or 500 hours, and we get to see him about 2 minutes.
Sociologists and psychologists tried to analyze it. Parents tried to put up with it. Police tried to cope with it. No one succeeded very well, except the Beatles. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, known to the younger set as the Fab Four, are young musicians in their early 20s who wear their hair long and their clothing tight. Their 32-day American tour saw them give concerts in 24 cities and gross nearly $2 million. Except for the locale or personalities involved, each city, each news conference, and each concert were the same, and so was the response. The Beatles arrived, stayed, and departed under heavy police guard, more concentrated in most cases than protection afforded world dignitaries. News conference questions were the same everywhere, and so were the answers.
But we didn't come here intending to sightsee.
What did you intend to do?
To do about 30 shows and make some money.
It was good fun. Except when it fell in the river.
Who fell in the river?
Nobody in line, you see. You never trust anybody, can they?
The Beatles sang the same songs in every city, and they performed for 30 minutes. Audiences, generally at or near capacity in the largest halls or stadiums available, reacted similarly. From the moment a stagehand carried the Mop Top's instruments on stage until the time the Beatles took their final bows, the scene was that of mass hysteria. Girls by the thousands stood, waving articles of clothing, throwing combs, binoculars, and jelly beans. In Chicago, a raw T-bone steak was tossed on George Harrison's left foot. The sound emanating from the audience was so loud and piercing that it nearly shattered one's eardrum. The noise level of the high-pitched hysterical screams was so high it caused one's nasal passages to vibrate. Few who paid to see the Beatles ever heard them, but it apparently didn't matter. Later, they could go home and listen to Beatle records. They had obviously come to worship their idols by the noisiest methods available. Those of us on the tour went to sleep and wakened to the familiar chant, "We want the Beatles." Police and hotel officials quickly discovered that Beatlemaniacs would, could, and did go to any extremes in their attempts to catch a glimpse of these British ambassadors of the beat. Teenagers, some accompanied by parents, remained in hotel lobbies or air terminals for 24 hours or more in hopes of catching a glimpse of a Beatle. A handful succeeded, but generally those who did ended by losing control of their emotions. I saw a girl in New Orleans break through a police line, grab Paul McCartney, kiss him, scream, "I love you, Paul," and then she fainted. By some miraculous manner, the Beatles escaped injury. Many of their fans weren't as fortunate. Several girls, and mothers too, were trampled in the crowds or they fell in attempts to gain higher vantage points. The most serious injury occurred in Dallas, where three youngsters were cut, one seriously, by a plate glass window smashed by a surging crowd trying to gain entrance to the Beatles' motel. One performance in Cleveland was stopped by police until order was restored. The Beatles' major complaint was the makeup of items hurled at them during the concerts. Although the quartet seemed to comprehend better than those students of human behavior the reason for this unusual expression of adulation, nevertheless, it did concern them. John Lennon said,
"Please, please, that's all I say. No jelly beans and bits of cake and things, and combs. We've got combs."
The Beatles' tour ended in New York City at a charity performance in the famed Paramount Theater. The following day, they departed for their homeland, accompanied by their youthful personal manager, Brian Epstein, and their ex-press agent, Derek Taylor, who moments before boarding the plane told me he had quit. His reason?
"Personal disagreement between me and Brian Epstein, which has nothing to do with the Beatles, who are still splendid, nor with the tremendous success of the trip, which is undeniable. It's too bad. It's life. All show business, anyway."
Since their phenomenal tour, drummer Ringo Starr has undergone a tonsillectomy. During his hospital stay, daily medical bulletins concerning his condition were issued, and Paul McCartney has been quoted as saying he will marry British actress Jane Asher. Unlike the screams heard on the tour, they were this time not those of adulation, but those of anguish. This is Art Schreiber in Cleveland.
And thank you. Well, That was the wrap-up. Now, you heard, you cannot believe the screaming. My hearing loss today, I blame on following the Beatles. You could not hear anything, and no one heard any of the songs they sang and played for 30 minutes. It was nothing but hysteria. Now, I didn't realize, though, that those of us who were close to the Beatles on that tour were targets as well, because, see, people who couldn't reach a Beatle, the next best thing was to touch one of us. And I lost 3 suits on that tour. Just girls with fingernails would grab you and just claw at you and just shred your jacket into your shirt, and all of us went through that. I didn't realize one morning. Now, let me tell you, there was a reporter from Britain by the name of, guess what, George Harrison. He covered the Beatles, and I got to know him. And one morning, he and I were getting a cab back to the Lafayette Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Atlantic City, and I noticed this old suitcase he was carrying, and that he had written in white paint on this old suitcase. Folks, it should have been in a museum in London. It was so old and decrepit that I thought, well, he probably bought it. It was in the Battle of Trafalgar or something. But anyway, he had written G. Harrison across this thing. And I said to him, I said, why'd you do that? And he said, well, I'm getting mixed up with the George Harrison, the Beatle. And he said, so that's how I can tell it's my suitcase. Well, when we got in the cab, I said, the Lafayette Hotel. And the cab driver said, come, I can't get within 5 blocks of that place. The Beatles are there. I said, yeah, well, do the best you can. And sure enough, it was a long way away, and thousands of teenagers around. We stop the cab, get out, and the next thing I know, George Harrison, the correspondent, is on the ground. Girls are pulling at his pants, clawing at him, and the poor cab driver is under the cab, halfway under. They're grabbing him, and the next thing I know, I go down. Here is what it sounded like. Yeah.
Don't watch the street. Don't
What do you got that in your hand for? What do you got that in your hand for?
Are you staying with the Beatles?
Yes!
Please, don't. This is a recorder.
Why? What we're saying?
Yeah, you're being recorded.
Hi!
We want Ringo!
Ringo!
We want
Ringo!
Ringo!
Okay. We want Ringo!
The police finally rescued us. And, folks, when they saw, the cab driver opened the trunk of the cab, and when those kids saw G. Harrison on there, they grabbed that suitcase, and it came open, and the clothing went flying. Today, there is somebody somewhere that has a pair of underwear they swear is George Harrison. Now, they're right. It was George Harrison, the correspondent, but not George Harrison, the Beatle. Second night that I was on the tour, John Lennon came up to me and said, he said, you play Monopoly. I said, well, I play with my kids. He said, I got a board. I said, a what? He said, I got a board. I got a Monopoly board. He said, George and I play. He said, these other guys won't play. They play poker. And I said, he said, well, you play. I said, yeah, I'll play. Well, I didn't realize I was committing myself to night after night after night playing Monopoly with these two guys. And George was always the banker. And we played not seriously. You know how long one game takes. Well, a game would end and John would say, let's play one more, one more. And I'd be falling asleep and he'd poke me. He'd say, it's your turn. And I'd say, you guys can sleep all day tomorrow. I got to work all day. And he'd say, one more game. And we'd play till the sun came up. Well, anyway, during a lot of the times, I couldn't believe what people threw, what the kids threw at the Beatles on stage. Not to hurt them, although that T-bone steak that nearly decapitated Paul and landed on George Harrison's foot was a frozen T-bone steak and thrown from the mezzanine in the old Cow Palace in Chicago. But anyway, they threw in adulation, in their desire to worship the Beatles. I talked to John Lennon about it, and here is that conversation.
John, what were they throwing up on a stage in Philadelphia last night?
Everything bar their limbs, I think.
I know jelly beans were thrown. Anything else?
Jelly beans, yeah. There was a sort of carton of milk, or half-empty carton of milk, a bit of cake I had stood in. It's not much fun, you know.
How about all the cakes that you get? Do you like cake?
We're not all that keen on it. We're going off it gradually. There's mania for cakes, only to the thought, you see. And if we do get stuck with a lot of cakes, which sometimes happens, we always give them to somebody or other.
You were saying the Americans must have a great yen for cakes, don't they?
Well, either that or they're very good cooks. They like making cakes, you know.
Somebody asked you in the news conference yesterday about Pittsburgh. What was your remark? They said that they wouldn't let you in any of the hotels in Pittsburgh.
Oh, I said I didn't think we were going to Pittsburgh. I didn't know we were going to Pittsburgh, I think.
And which is really true. You don't know all the cities that you're going on. You just kind of get on a plane and go to the next stop, don't you?
Well, when we got here, or before we got here, we were given a list of all the cities. There were so many.
Yeah.
It's just not worth learning them. We just learn them on the way there.
Anything that's really bothered you on the tour? Or anything that's kind of gotten to you?
Nothing really. I'd just prefer if the kids wouldn't throw, you know, anything. I know they only want to give us jelly beans, but we don't like them.
You don't like me?
You know. And it hurts. And it's dangerous, you know.
Maybe they could toss these streamers or something, you know, papers.
Streamers, great. Yeah. Balloons, things like that. You know, it's all, nobody gets hurt, but jelly beans and bits of cake. Because they must know we can't eat them once we've trodden on them. And they do. The American jelly beans are hard. In England, it was bad.
Phone!
You know, but they're only soft jelly beans over there, and it was rough then. But over here, they're made out of rock.
Have you been hit with any? I mean, actually, you know, hit in the head.
Yeah, last night I got hit with two. And it's hard to sort of sing if you're smiling. And one just got me on the temple. Another one got me on the chest. And one got George on the guitar hand. He had to stop playing, you know. It sounded like complaining, but we like the idea. If they have to sell us them, even though we don't like them, send us them. I mean, send them, you know, like people send letters or parcels, rather than throw them. Please, please, that's all I say. No jelly beans and bits of cake and things. And combs. We've got combs.
And that was the way John looked at it. You just cannot believe the stage was littered with cake. Cupcakes, big cakes, small cakes, and jelly beans. But one thing great in Detroit, they performed at the old Joe Louis Arena, which is a hockey arena, and it was they had put the stage where one of the goals is. And so everybody was above them. You know, looking down on the hockey rink. Well, the Beatles were really fair game for everything that they were hurled from the stands. But what was amazing was they threw a lot of jewelry and watches and things, and all the cops were going on the stage after the performance, sticking all that stuff in their pockets. So it was wonderful. Okay, now another thing that Paul did that the police asked him not to do, and of course he would love to do it. Now, first, I'd like, if there's anyone in this audience that knows how in the world all those kids knew where the Beatles' suite was or the room that they were staying. But they did. You know, when you look at the hotel building and all the rooms, the windows look the same, right? But no, those kids knew which window was the Beatles. And Paul would stand by that window and flip the curtain or the drape and just hear the eruption from the crowd down on the street. And the police would ask them not to. I went down and was interviewing and seeing what I could find out about how those people knew where the room was. And so I come back up, and Paul was still standing by the window. And I walked up to him, and here was that conversation.
Paul, are you going to get a chance to wave? I understand the rumor, at least. I was down among the crowd, and they
I saw you.
Did you?
I saw you, yeah, from the window.
Well,
I saw the police moving you on, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They're moving everybody on down there.
I thought so, yeah.
Are you going to get to wave to them?
Well, I was waving before, actually. The police told us not to, but I thought, be a bit sneaky, you know. A little bit of a sneaky trick, and we'll wave.
Give them a break.
Well, you know, I mean, I'd feel daft if I was down there in the crowd and nobody was waving. Actually, there's been somebody waving from one of the top windows anyway. Not one of us, but, you know.
Were you concerned at all last night when they started to storm the stage?
No. Because, you know, it looks more frightening than it actually is. Because, I mean, did you see the amount of police that came out? It was like a little army, you know. Well, you can't be worried when you know all that amount of cops are there, you know, to look after you.
And that's just the way it was. And no matter where they went, those kids could tell which was their room. And I'll still to this day never know how that happened. Now comes the occasion where Paul McCartney saved my career. And I mean this. He really did. Go back to what I was telling you, that the bureau chief did not like me covering the Beatles tour, even though I did get to cover the Democratic Convention, which he wanted. But he didn't think the story was worth the kind of coverage that we were giving it. I received a call from him in Milwaukee. Now, it's interesting. All the stories that I covered, all those civil rights stories, the politics, the man space, Jim Snyder was a wonderful editor, a great bureau chief. I loved him. He's passed away now, but he was just a super editor and a super supervisor, a great bureau chief. But he wouldn't talk to me. He always gave me tips on, hey, you ought to look at this angle of the story, or, hey, how about this? How about that? But no, not when I was on the Beatles tour. He wouldn't talk to me at all. When I called in my 15 stories a day, he never talked to me. I get a call in Milwaukee, and it's from Snyder. He said, my daughter, Margaret Ann, is going to see the Beatles in when they come to Baltimore. He says, I want autographs. Well, now, folks, this was the one thing that we could not do. I don't know whether anyone else did, but I never asked a Beatle for an autograph because we made a pledge. When we started on the tour, I made it after I was joined them because I was informed by Derek Taylor, their press agent, that we would not ask for autographs. You think that I didn't want to get some autographs? Do you know that I was in Philadelphia and standing in the back of the room? Because when we who covered the Beatles, when they had a news conference in every town, we would not really sit at the news conference because that was for the local press, and we were with the Beatles all the time, so we didn't stand at the table or sit at the table where the other reporters, the local press, was. And I was in the back, and this elderly gentleman, I don't think he was as old as I am today, but he seemed old to me at that time. He came up to me and he said, and he saw Westinghouse Group W on my tape recorder. He said, "I know your boss." Well, I thought he was talking about the bureau chief. He was talking about the president of the company. And he said, I'm good friends of his. I said, "Oh, well, thank you." And he said, "I want autographs of the Beatles for my grandchildren." I said, "Sir, I can't do it." He said, "Young man, do you know who I am?" I said, "No, sir." He said, my name is Gimbel. I own the department store in New York and here." And we were in Philadelphia. He said, "I want autographs." He said, "Young man, you can have anything in my store. Just get me autographs." Oh, I wanted to get autographs so badly. But I didn't get him any autographs. Okay, now Snyder hung up on me when I told Jim, "I can't get you autographs." Okay, I knew I was in deep trouble. Now the tour is almost over. We're on our way back to New York, where the Beatles were to perform that night at the Paramount Theater in New York, and go home the next day. By the way, I have a ticket to that performance in my shadow box in my apartment, and it's a picture of it in my scrapbook. By the way, I just did this presentation, similar to what you're hearing today, to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland 1 month ago. And thank you. And I have donated my scrapbook to the Rock Hall. So anyway, that ticket that I had, the cost of that ticket to see the Beatles at the Paramount Theater in New York City was $2.50. I've been offered $4,000 for the ticket. Okay, so Paul McCartney, I sat with Lennon on the plane all the time. And Paul came up to talk to John, and he said, "Where's John?" And I said, "I don't know." And he started to walk away, and I said, "Paul, wait a minute. Do me a favor." And he saw me fumbling with my tape recorder I kept under my seat. And he said, "What?" And I said, "My boss's daughter saw you." He said, would you say something to her?" He said, "Turn it on. Here is what it sounded like."
We're on the plane almost to New York, and Paul McCartney is beside me, and this interview is for Margaret Ann Snyder. Paul, she saw you in Baltimore. She waved to you, and she thinks that she saw you wave to her.
Of course I did. I remember her now very well. Margaret Ann Snyder, there she was, looking a picture, looking like a vision. And she waved, and I thought, "That's Margaret Ann Snyder," I thought, shouting. So I thought, well, I'd better wave back, hadn't I? And with a gay wave of my hand, I waved back. Of course, I'd recognize her anywhere. She's the girl with the long fair hair, and her father's got a little black penknife. I know her anywhere. Yes.
Paul, I know that she'd like to see you in New York, but you're going to have to leave tomorrow, so I'll bet she'll even be waving from Baltimore when you're leaving from New York.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll wave from New York.
All right.
And if she waves from Baltimore, and we might see each other on telly.
Fine. And if I see her, I'll be sure and then send your personal message to her, right?
Okay, give her my love then, Art. Lots of love, Margaret Ann Snyder. Goodbye, and I'll see you.
And by the way,
yes?
My wife Alice, who you met in Cleveland, and was very sorry she didn't meet the rest of you, she said to me on the phone this morning, be sure and tell Paul I said hello. So I think there's something going there.
Something going. Yeah, me and Alice, don't worry. Okay, Alice, don't tell Art, but I'll meet you tonight. Okay, Alice? Right. Keep it quiet, though, Alice. See you, Alice. Lots of love. Don't tell Art, though.
Well, I think you can see that Paul and I had a pretty good relationship. And my dear wife, who unfortunately passed away of breast cancer at age 46, but she did get to meet Paul, and I got to kid him. But when I got back home, I had the engineers cut that part out about Alice, but I had them put onto a cassette the message to Margaret Ann Snyder. And without a note or anything, I had it sent to Jim Snyder. About a week later, I got a call from Jim. He said, we had a babysitter last night. I took the babysitter home. When I came back, I went by Margaret Ann's room, and I thought I heard something. I pushed the door open, and she was laying there with the tape recorder by her ear. And she looked up at me, and she said, he said my name. He said my name. Well, folks, that saved my career. And finally, if you remember, you young people don't, but in the old days, we didn't have ramps at airports. We had stairs that came out of the fuselage of the plane. And you walked up the steps, and there was a platform at the top where you could stand and wave to those you were saying goodbye to, and then go into the plane. Well, the Beatles, you can hear them yelling, goodbye, Art, goodbye, Art, as this cut, as they're leaving.
See you, Art.
See ya.
There the Beatles are entering the plane as the fans stand on the concourse above, screaming and yelling and waving goodbye, as you hear them in the background, because the Beatles are soon to depart for England, ending this month-long American-Canadian tour, a most fabulously successful tour. More than $1 million the Beatles have collected on this tour, as well as thousands upon thousands of fans with that familiar scream and chant.
And that was the departure of the Beatles. They did come back the next year. Larry Kane covered that tour also. He, to my knowledge, was the only reporter to cover both tours of the all of the five of us that covered. Larry did cover the next one. I know I didn't, and I don't think the others did. I know Ivor Davis didn't. It was probably the most difficult assignment I had ever had. I had the privilege of traveling with great people like Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Barry Goldwater, great senator from Illinois, Everett Dirksen, and other many dignitaries, Hubert Humphrey, vice president, who ran for president, was defeated. Nothing ever equaled what it was like trying to cover the Beatles. And, even traveling with a great person like Martin Luther King, the people wanted autographs, but they were certainly didn't throw things at him. And I know he was assassinated, and a tragic event. But if the Beatles were just a phenomenon that nothing has come along since, before or since, and I don't know that it ever will, but that was the way it was. And the favorite expression from, as I talk to young women today, I say, you go home and tell your grandmother I heard her screaming at a Beatles. And the favorite expression of mothers coming up to us wanting to meet a Beatle, and I would say, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. And then came this favorite expression, no, you don't understand. I want to make them happy. That was very common that we experienced all throughout the tour. Now, I'll bet you have some questions.
Call out your name. You know the drill, guys.
Can you hear me? Okay. This is Cheryl Echeverria, and I have a question. Do you still keep in touch with either Ringo or Paul?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you keep in touch with either Ringo or Paul?
No. I wish I could. Larry Kane and I both have tried to reach them. When Ringo came to Albuquerque to perform at a casino, a Native American casino in the city, even our newspaper of record, the Albuquerque Journal, couldn't get me in. And they couldn't get in either. However, our governor, Bill Richardson, who is a good friend of mine and still is a good friend of mine and was at that time, he got in. I didn't know that he was even going to the performance or I would have gone with him. But I have not been able to get to Paul or Ringo, and neither has Larry. I think if we could get by their people, I talked about this on the radio in Buffalo last night evening. Tom had me on. By the way, great. I really admired his ability as an interviewer. What's his last name?
Bowerly.
Okay. He had a drummer who is, according to Tom, is knows more about Ringo's drums than anyone in the world. And this guy has talked to Ringo, but he told me that he has great difficulty now getting to Ringo. So I'm sorry, but I wish I could, because I know if I could get to them, we could reminisce and have good times about the tour.
Others? I didn't hear the call.
Okay.
Oh, Grasso? Okay.
Grasso. During the tour, when you did that tour with the Beatles, have you ever run into Cousin Bruce Morrow with that?
Cousin Brucey?
Yeah, have you ever run into Bruce Morrow during the tour?
No.
You haven't?
He was on a couple of stops, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
When he worked for ABC, he
was not on the tour, but he would appear. You know, there were lots of disc jockeys that did, because you know, it was a big deal. As I told you, the ratings intensity was enormous in those days, and so the fight for ratings was so intense that guys did anything to, you know, they would make a stop and see and get maybe one interview or talk to a Beatle, and that was a big deal because they played that for all it was worth on their radio station.
Okay, so. You love the Beatles. Good, good.
Sir, when you were with them, I bet you were
know, didn't realize it, that you were going to be with obviously, I mean, you were glad to be with them, but I mean, you were startled or were you shocked to be with them?
Was he what?
Were you shocked? No.
Shocked?
Yeah.
Were you surprised or shocked that you got the job?
That
you got the assignment?
No, that I got the assignment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. In fact, I went home. Now, if right. my son were here in this audience,
right.
he would stand up and say, "Pop, name us three Beatles songs," and I couldn't do it. He would also tell you that the last person in the world that should have ever been assigned to the Beatles tour was his father, who knew nothing about music. I don't know anything today about music. I didn't know who the Beatles were.
Oh, God.
I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show. Yes, I had. But when I got the assignment, I went home and said to my wife, "We got to go see Hard Day's Night." She said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "I just got assigned to the Beatles tour, and I don't know anything about them." And we went to a drive-in because we couldn't get a babysitter, and I fell asleep. And the thing that John Lennon really loved about us, we didn't talk right. about music. John Lennon was so interested in what was happening in America at the time. He could not understand what was happening sociologically. President Kennedy had right. been assassinated. He had met President Kennedy, was very upset about that. But then the civil rights riots were going on, and he could not understand what was happening. And he wanted to talk about that. When he found out that I had traveled with the people that I have traveled with, that's what John wanted to talk about. And I was delighted because I didn't know anything about music. Now, let me tell you how stupid I am, though.
You're not stupid, sir.
You didn't have to answer that. I'll answer it for you. John and Paul wrote a lot of music on the plane. And Paul would come up. As I told you, John and I sat together. And Paul would come up to John, and they would confer and collaborate, and then they'd toss the sheet of paper on the floor. The floor of the plane was littered with that stuff that they were writing, and I didn't pick up one piece of it. I don't know anybody else did either. Yeah. That's how how we could have done that, I don't know to this day, folks.
Another thing I would like to know, when I saw him on the Ed Sullivan Show, this going back in the 60s, I thought they were going to sing Hard Day's Night, which they didn't. They sang the other songs they made, and I loved the Hard Day's Night. That was my favorite.
Well, it's funny. Now, I'll tell you, I got to watch Hard Day's Night, and I didn't fall asleep, with the Beatles in Atlantic City. They brought in film, and we watched it in the Beatles suite with the Beatles. They watched it again. They had seen it before, but they watched it again.
Other questions? I didn't hear over to my left here. Oh, Melissa, go ahead. Go ahead, Melissa. No.
Did you have a favorite Beatle?
Yes. No question. Of course, Paul should be because he saved my you-know-what. John, because John and I spent so much time together. We spent that time on the plane playing Monopoly with George. So, obviously, I was closer to John than any of the others. But Paul was really, Paul and I became good friends. We got off to a rough start at one time, and in fact, if you see my scrapbook, you'll see he wrote above his picture not only something about Alice, but then he wrote Sorry. He had apologized to me for something that which I took offense to and told him. Well, I'll tell you, I said what it was on the radio last night. Paul, when we were in Dallas, folks, you probably can't imagine this today, but in the South, you couldn't walk into a bar and buy a drink. It was illegal. And so what happened was hotels and motels started having forming private clubs. And when you signed in to the hotel or motel, you were a member of the private club, and therefore you could buy a drink. And the motel we stayed at in Dallas had cocktail waitresses that were dressed as Playboy bunnies, and very attractive young women in those scanty costumes. And they came up for a photo op in the Beatles suite. And when they were leaving, Paul said to me, get me her, get me. And I said, I'm not your pimp, get her yourself. And Paul was really ticked at me for quite a while, but then he came to me and apologized. So I have to say that I was very close to Paul too, and I think maybe that had something to do with him saving my Fanny.
Yep, Lucy. Lucy, hold on for the mic.
Did you ever beat George and John at Monopoly?
Oh, yes. I won every once in a while. George won a lot, too. John accused George of cheating. I don't think he did. He was always the banker. So I know it's easy for a banker to cheat at Monopoly. But I don't think he did. John, I think, kidded him more than anything else. See, John only cared about landing and owning Park Place and Boardwalk. Well, of course, as you know, those are the two most expensive properties on the board, and they're great if you have enough money then to build houses, but before he could get any houses built, he generally went bankrupt because, and so, but he was happy as long as he got Park Place and Boardwalk. If he didn't get Park Place and Boardwalk, he was really grumpy about it. Yeah. But I did. I won my share. George won. John did not win very much.
Others? Yeah, I can't quite hear in the back. Who's calling? Daniel? Yeah, hold on. Wave your hand so we can get the mic to you.
Hi, Art. Thank you so much for talking to us today. My question is, did you have any contact with John Lennon after that tour, after 1964?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. I stayed in touch with John over the years. And in 1979, this is very hard for me to tell this story without choking up. My wife had passed away in 1975, and I was trying to raise two teenagers as a single parent. And I had the great opportunity, and it was a great opportunity. Westinghouse named me the manager of WINS, and that was a great opportunity for me. My kids did not want to leave L.A. and go to New York. I wanted to go badly, but I had an obligation, I felt, as a parent, to raise my children the best I could, and I resigned from the company after being named general manager of WINS. And I had stayed in touch with John, and so in 19, that was about 1977. I then decided, I was offered the presidency of a big ride-sharing organization in L.A., which I had started as a promotion for my radio station. I didn't think of it any other way. I wanted to promote ride-sharing because the oil embargo was going on and started in 1972. And, you know, we had long gas lines. And so I started Commuter Computer. And here was offered the presidency of it. They didn't know that I had resigned my position from Westinghouse. And so I ran that, and I still stayed in touch with John. I was then hired by Hubbard Broadcasting Company to manage their big 50,000-watt station in Minneapolis, which they wanted to turn from rock and roll to a news talk station. And they hired me. And I called John, and I said, "Guy, I got a job in Minneapolis that's closer to New York. How about I come to New York and sit down with you with the tape recorder, and let's reminisce about the tour, because I'd like to write a magazine piece or a book maybe for 1984. This was 1979 now. 84 would have been the 20th anniversary of the tour. And he said, "Great, great idea." And we set a date. This was 1979, late in the year, in December. And we set a date for me to come to New York, and it was 1 week after he was assassinated. So I never got my dream. Okay.
I'll talk about your book a little bit. Art's got, speaking of books, Art's got a book.
Folks, I do want to talk about my book, because while I wrote this book with a friend of mine who he wrote it as told by me. And the reason I wanted to do it was I wanted to try to help people who are losing sight or have gone blind. I woke up blind. And that was, I thought my life was over. I really did. And the National Federation of the Blind saved my life and turned it around. And I have always tried, however I can, to help the NFB. And what I'm doing here, and I thank all of you, I'm here not to be paid. Thank you for paying my expenses. But I have not asked the NFB for any stipend as I do these presentations around the country. In the last few days, I've been Utah, then Colorado, Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and then I had to go to Bainbridge Island, not for the NFB, but that was for a friend, and now thankfully to you, all of you. But I wanted to help the NFB and promote the NFB. So I wrote the book, Out of Sight, Blind But Doing All Right, and I hope that that's what happens. It is the story not of the Beatles, not of Jack Kennedy or something, although there's a story about Kennedy in there, but it's really the story of my waking up blind and what I did and getting with the NFB and how it changed my life. That's the story of the book. It's in big print, and it only takes you about an hour and a half to read it. So that's
also have it on audio CD, is that correct?
Yes, and it's on CD, which is done by a friend of mine as a broadcaster. And here, I will tell you this. If I knew Braille well enough, see, I could have done it myself, but I don't know Braille that well, and so therefore I wasn't able to do it.
You have it with you. You have the books with you today, Art?
I have them right here.
You have them right here. How much are they, Art?
They're I sell them to you for $10 a book, the print at $15 for the CDs, and whatever Carl or the Federation wants to sell them for, and the rest of the money can go to the Federation. That's up to you. But that's what my my partner and I make on the CDs. We make $1 each, and we make 50 cents on the printed book each. So
you're not getting rich on those. You're not getting rich on those.
No.
But Mindy and I are going to take the audio book. Mindy, put one aside.
I did. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Sorry, I didn't get a chance to call my name out. It's actually a two-part question. One is, how long ago did you lose your bit? Oh, I guess I should be talking into the mic, right?
I guess you should. Like we told everybody else.
I keep telling everybody, Mike, they don't hear you online, so I keep telling everybody that, and then I'm going to yell. All right. First, my question is two part. One is, how long ago did you go blind? And the second part of my question is, when you're talking to us about all of these things that happened earlier in your life, are you still picturing them as a sighted person?
Am I what?
Still picturing. The first question is, how long ago did you lose your vision?
I lost my vision. I woke up blind August 22nd, 1982.
Oh.
I had just come to Albuquerque, New Mexico to manage KOB, a big 50,000-watt station. Stan Hubbard, who had hired me in Minneapolis, called me up. One day I was visiting my kids out in L.A., and he said, Schreiber, I know you don't like the weather up here. He was calling me from Minneapolis, and he was right about that. And I know you like the sunshine. I want you to go to Albuquerque. I'll pay you more money. I said, Stan, stop. I'm on my way. And I was there. That was a Friday. I was there Monday. And less than 9 months later, I woke up, and the lights were out.
Talking to my mic, not you, but, you know.
There we go. So when you woke up, I'm sorry, this isn't part of my question, but I have to ask it. So when you woke up blind and you realized that you were blind, we didn't get to you fast enough for you to keep that job, did we?
No. I knew nothing about blindness. I knew no blind people. And the man that really did it for me was my great friend Jerry Landay, who was my bureau chief when I was a bureau chief. He ran my London and Foreign News Service for me. He later became White House correspondent for ABC radio, and then he went to work for CBS, the old Charles Kuralt Sunday morning show. Called me up after doing a feature on a reading machine, and he said, you got to get this. I just did this feature. It's terrific. You got to get it. And he gives me, my nurse, the number that I'm to call. And I didn't know it was $35,000. It was the Kurzweil reading machine, the size of a small washing machine. And I call this David Tiki, a guy in Boston.
Yeah,
I didn't know. He worked for Xerox Corporation, the manufacturer of the Kurzweil reading machine. And I'm saying, I want this reading machine. And he's trying to question me about my blindness. And I am irritated about this. And I said, I want this reading machine. And here is the greatest piece of advice, folks, I've ever been given. David Tiki said, wait a minute. He said, my friend, if you're blind, how long you been blind? I said, 3 months. He said, my friend, you better learn to function as a blind man before you get a reading machine. And he said, do you know Fred Schroeder? I said, no. He said, well, he's the best white cane travel guy in the country, and he's president of the National Federation of the Blind. When you get back to Albuquerque, I was in L.A. going through these surgeries. He said, when you get back to Albuquerque, give them a call. And I called Fred Schroeder, and the rest is history. That's how I got with the NFB. Yeah.
And so my next question is, when you tell us these stories about the Beatles, are you seeing this all before your eyes as you're talking to us?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's what I wondered about. I've never had any vision, so I wondered.
Yeah.
If,
yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Thanks. Okay.
You know,
Carl, did you want to?
Carl.
Yeah. You're up.
Yeah, I guess so. Art. Yeah. I'm gonna be able to take about two more.
You got
two,
Wilbur.
Yeah.
You got Wilbur.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I will. I'll get you. But we're gonna be able to take two or three more questions because we have several other things to do before this is over. But Art's gonna be at the banquet tonight, and maybe I'll get him to sing a Beatles song. Or do something to add a little more to that. If you can think of another couple of anecdotes, Art, all you have to do is pull on my jacket or Mindy's dress or something and get a hold of our, get our attention. We'll get you on there to do a soft shoe or something. Wilbur, you had a question.
Here, Wilbur. Mr. Schreiber?
Yes.
It was a great program. I loved it.
Thank you.
And I'd like to say that in 1959, this organization had its national convention in New Mexico.
That's right. Of course, I didn't know that.
And lastly, I often hear the story between you and Ken Jernigan on how you brush your teeth.
That's right. He was the one that taught me an alternative technique, and I've used it in many speeches, and people to this day come up to me many years after I've spoken somewhere and said, you know, I brush, and they're sighted people, I brush my teeth just the way you said you were taught. And that was, you know, sighted people go to brush their teeth and they go to put the paste on the brush and boom, and it drops into the sink. Well, that never happens to me. I take the top off my toothpaste tube, stick it in my mouth, squeeze out some paste. I don't waste a drop. Folks, thank you so much. I want to thank all of you. Good luck.